Bumblecast. I'm your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always is that morally righteous, but is he also duplicitously evil, Kyle Krause.
Oh, I don't know. You'll have to find out throughout the course of this episode.
And hopefully just this episode, no flip-flopping. But that's for the topic later. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
I am fine. Tired. It's been a heck of a week.
Oh yeah, what's happening in the Ian's world? Is there anything you can talk about?
Nothing I can talk about.
Of course not.
Lots of projects that you know are in various stages of doing. Like here, this project you've been wanting to be a part of for years. We finally got it going in a direction. Would you like to be a part? Yeah, sure. Or here, this finally got approved, so you can move on to this next stage of development. All right, let me do all that. This, that, and the other. And in the meantime, if you've been following us on Bubblecast Gaming, you've seen some of my playing of Death Stranding.
Yeah.
Newest entry into Hideo Kojima's catalog of interesting gaming experiences.
Yeah, I watched you play a little bit of this.
It's
fascinatingly crazy, I guess.
Here's the thing, like the core gameplay mechanics.
It's not too
the central
wild.
Gameplay loop is incredibly mundane.
Yes, yes.
Grab package, take package to place, repeat.
Truck simulator.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. So I can relate.
I've spent an inordinate amount of time building up the second map and completing just the highways.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I see other people doing drops here and there or creating power stations or post boxes, which is cute and all, but I've been building the highway, okay? Like, if you're on my server, and if you happen to see the name Bumble King attached to one of the auto pavers, know that I have pretty much built the entire highway from Lake Knot City to South Knot City, okay? I've virtually already built the road running from the highway all the way out to Mountain Knot City, all right? That's me. I did most of that. I mean, folks have contributed as well. I'm not diminishing the team effort here. But I have been pouring myself into this bloody highway, and it feels so good, Kyle, when the highway is done, because your vehicles don't run out of battery when you're on the highway, and you can bypass most of the stupidity when you're on the highway, and just zoom, 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 zoom.
Why is everything called Knot City? Is it a clever wordplay? Are they trying to say this is not a city, or is it just something? Is it just Kojima being Kojima?
I think it's Kojima being Kojima in that, in his subtle way. You know, there's a great number of themes around strands and strings and things that bind, and one of the characters wears a kipu, the Native American way of keeping records by tying knots at specific sizes and distances along lengths of string.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that the cities being knots are supposed to be indicative of some kind of grand continental kipu representing America.
All right. Sure. Okay.
I mean, the main character is Sam Porter Bridges.
I know.
He's a porter for the company Bridges. You might as well just call him Uncle Sam at this point and put everything on the nose, you know? It's...
And then there's a guy who wears a stupid-looking skull mask named Die Hard Man.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a guy who basically defies physics named Higgs after Higgs boson.
And then there's like, the main characters, like, there's a main character whose last name is Strand. It's like, what? What are you doing, Kojima? What are you doing?
And here's the thing. If you take the plunge and just accept the sci-fi scenario that he has posited, in that we are in the near future post-apocalypse where we attempted to use the alternate dimension that is death to build the new internet, and that didn't go well, so we're trying to do it again.
All right.
And you can try to avoid the ghosts that appear in the brain that's made out of time by strapping a baby, because it's taken from a dead mother, so it's halfway between life and death. If you just accept all that, okay?
Sure.
That's a lot on your plate, but if you just accept that,
uh-huh.
The narrative thus far has been fairly cogent. Like, I'm about, I'd say, a little under halfway through the game's story. Mm-hmm. I just started episode 6 out of 14.
Right.
And the character motivations that have been revealed make sense for the characters within the context. The reveals that have been made pretty much work within the rules that have been set, and the political intrigue that is starting to trickle in follows a reasonable path, again, within the crazy context. It doesn't quite feel like the Metal Gear stuff where it's coming out of left field and you have to do some mental gymnastics to make it fit. This actually feels like it's progressing and filling in a reasonable narrative.
Hmm.
Which is weird for a Kojima game.
maybe that's been the secret all along.
Now,
it's actually almost coherent.
I am, only halfway-ish through the game, so there's plenty of room for surprises. And a lot of Metal Gear comes from being based on, very loosely, real-world events and basically telling the story backwards.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause Metal Gear happens more or less in the middle of the saga, and about half the games in the entire franchise seem to revolve around Big Boss, so it takes place before the original Metal Gear. It's, I don't know, we could probably do a whole episode talking about this stuff, but yeah. For right now, if you've been on the fence about the game, I will say it may not be for everyone. I like the very slow pace, make your way across the terrain, gather resources, dump them into something to build, avoid the plot as much as possible, and just build, build, build. That's cool to me. If you want something more like Metal Gear, then it may not be for you. And if you want something that's more action-packed and high-paced, maybe not your cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this much, and this will be my closing thought on the game for now. It does an excellent job of using the game mechanics to reinforce the theme of the game. The whole theme of the game is bringing the people together to create a stronger whole. That's Sam's mission. Go across the continental United States, bring everyone onto the network, and rebuild the country. And the entire game is based on this asynchronous multiplayer where everyone can contribute to the same public works, the roads. If somebody builds a shortcut, you can use it, or you can help them improve it or complete it, build safe houses, leave vehicles for other people to find. So when you start off, it's very grindy because you're on your own. But as you make those connections, as you help other players and reap the benefits of their helping you, you are coming together to build a better functioning game world. And I'm really impressed that the message of the game is so clearly conveyed and worked into the mechanics. It's just a really neat concept and execution.
Wow, that's actually really cool. That's something that no one's said to me, or I haven't read anywhere. That sounds really interesting. See, when I was watching you play it, it was only early days in the game, so you were kind of mostly on your own. There wasn't a whole heck of a lot of connections being made with other players, so I was not really I was not really aware of that that level of connection and that level of the asynchronous multiplayer.
Like the early reviews that gave it, poor marks for being such a slog, I totally get that, because if you're playing offline by yourself,
oh yeah,
it's got to be torture. But having everyone come together and help each other out, it's just really nice.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Huh.
I mean, that's part of why I haven't advanced that much, is because I really want to pour a lot of effort into it so that people who are picking up the game later and get on my server have an easier time. Now, it's not like a cakewalk. You have to find certain regions and bring them onto the network before you can reap the benefits of everyone else. So you do have to do a little bit of work for it. But once you get on that network, the people who come on after me are going to see this wild and wonderful world just laid out for them. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Very nice. So we've had some Sonic-related news recently.
Yeah,
that I find very, very fascinating. I've always found, like, beta versions and prototypes and stuff like that very, very interesting. And Sonic 3 just recently had a prototype dumped courtesy of HiddenPalace.org, which has dumped many other Sonic-related prototypes in the past. But this is probably one of the biggest finds in Sonic development history.
Right up there with the Simon Y prototype.
Oh, yeah. Yep, definitely. This is a prototype of Sonic 3. Dated November 3rd, 1993, but believed to be earlier than that, as in November 3rd is just when this particular version was copied to the chips, was not necessarily when it was actually being worked on. It's believed to be earlier than that, and it shows a version of Sonic 3 that is essentially in the middle of being split into two different games. So we have basically the six core stages of Sonic 3 are in place. There is a vaguely playable version of Flying Battery Zone and some recoverable pieces of Lava Reef Zone. But other than that, that's it. You get the core six stages, which for the most part are kind of as you expect them to be. I've played a little bit of this. Angel Island Zone actually has a lot of changes and a lot of differences that would not signify that it's like the first stage in development. It's almost like they developed this game in reverse, because as you go through, the levels get slightly less buggy and they're a bit more, level layouts are a bit more true to what the final version would be. But basically, Sonic 3, from our understanding, Sonic 3 was a bit of a rush development and kind of a surprise that it even came together the way it did. For all intents and purposes, it sounds like the game should have been an utter complete failure. It should have just been a complete buggy mess, but somehow at the 11th hour, they managed to pull out this game that it's a lot shorter than a usual Sonic game, but they actually managed to polish it up really well in those final months. But it just goes to show that there's a lot of changes that get made during development. The biggest that I've seen is the music for Carnival Night, Ice Cap, and Launch Base. This is the most fascinating development of this whole thing to me. The music for... Ian, are you familiar with the Sonic & Knuckles collection for PC?
Yes, this was one of the first times that I realized, oh goodness, not everything is squeaky, clean, perfect, always as it was intended to be. Because it was something that I was discussing with Aaliyah years and years ago about how Ice Cap was one of my favorite tracks. And she goes, why? It's awful. I'm like, what are you talking about? And that's how we discovered she played the PC version. And I played the console version. And whoops, music's different.
Yeah, yeah. This was something that I discovered being a part of the Sonic fandom as a kid and going to all these forums and stuff at the time. Was knowing that Sonic & Knuckles had... the Sonic & Knuckles collection for PC had different music. And it's really fascinating because apparently that music in the Sonic & Knuckles collection is actually the original music intended for the game. So this prototype has Genesis versions of the PC... of the songs that were used in the PC version later on. I'd say Carnival Night sounds really good in both zones. Ice Cap and Launch Base are a bit rough around the edges. They're probably unfinished, based on differences between the MIDI versions and the versions that are in this prototype. They're probably not finished. But regardless, it's just kind of wild to think that those three zones and the credits music and the competition menu for two-player mode all had originally intended to have the were all originally intended to have the PC version's music all along. It was long believed that the PC version had those tracks replaced because of the involvement of one Michael Jackson, but that may not necessarily have been the case. So it's really, really fascinating to think about that. So
the one that bamboozles me is the drop dash.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Like, we all thought that was Christian Whitehead being brilliant, but did he somehow know? Was this like something circulated in the hacking community before it became apparent? Was this something that Sega said, hey, this is a dropped idea, do you want to use it? How did he know? Where did it come from for Sonic Mania?
According to him, it was just a coincidence. I don't know.
That's just crazy.
Yeah, well, the drop dash controls are different. Doing the drop dash in the Sonic 3 prototype is an exercise in frustration. It's very difficult. It doesn't always work. You have to hold up to do it. You have to hold up and then hold the button down, and then it kind of spin dashes you when you touch the ground. But it's very finicky. It doesn't always want to work. So the implementation in Sonic Mania is much better. And I really miss the Insta Shield, but that's just me. I'm just that guy.
There's also a little animation where Sonic reaches Angel Island, and instead of Knuckles punking the Chaos Emeralds out of him, he pops up and has a unique gesturing animation, as if to say, hand them over.
Or he just kind of like is holding... I like how Sonic runs up and Knuckles is just holding his hand up.
Yeah.
Like, he's just stop. Just stop. And then...
Red means stop.
And then he's... And then he kind of... He does make a gesture. I don't know if it's like hand him over or if it's just like, come get me. And then he takes off. But yeah, that's really weird. We've seen in the... I think the intro graphics... The intro graphics are different to Angel Island as well, where when Sonic's approaching, he's coming in on like a rocket surfboard.
Yep. That was found a while ago.
Instead of on the plane. But yeah, that's been known for a while, but it's really interesting to actually see it partially implemented here and being used how they intended it to be used.
Ah, it's just wild to think what might have been.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if we have these songs that are legit owned by Sega, and if the Michael Jackson involvement is an issue, just restore the old songs and give us the port. We have the Sonic 1 port, the Sonic CD port, the Sonic 2 port. Do it.
Maybe
those songs aren't the best versions, but by God, we can do it. Give it.
I have no idea what the deal is with that game. Because it will show up on like Genesis classics collections. It's been re-released numerous times, but it's never been like remade. So I don't know what the deal is with that game. It's shown up on like Sonic 3. Just Sonic 3 alone has shown up on like tons of retro collections for newer consoles and things like that. You can buy it on its own. It's standalone. It's on Steam. You can get it on Steam, Ian. But for some reason, there's just this really weird hang-up with it where they seem to not want to put it in. They put it in some things, but not other. It just doesn't make sense to me. I do not understand it at all.
Give us the remaster. Give us alternate tracks and put in Mighty and Ray. Just do it.
Yeah. Do it. Well, I guess we have Angel Island Revisited for... that, which is like a fan-made Christian Whitehead-style version of Sonic 3 and Knuckles. It's really well done. So, and it's sounding like these prototype tracks are going to be implemented into that version. So,
neat.
Yeah, they're going to rework them and bring them up. And I know that there's also remakes of the PC versions in Genesis style floating around there as well that are... They don't sound quite the same as the prototype versions, but they're pretty close. So, yeah, just some really, really fascinating stuff with the Sonic 3 prototype. Sadly, there are no missing levels, like levels that we didn't get to see, like in the Simon Y Sonic 2 prototype. So, like, there's no Genocide City or Wood Zone or anything like that that we're missing out on for Sonic 3. It seems like either they used all their ideas for zones or they never got to the point where they actually implemented any zone ideas they didn't use into the game. Yeah, that's about it. All of the music in the game, is implemented, so they had, like, Mushroom Hill, or Mushroom Valley as it's called, Flying Battery, Sandopolis, Lava Reef, Hidden Palace, Sky Sanctuary, Death Egg, and Doomsday Music were all there. They're all in the game, so they were apparently sitting on that music for a while. So that's it, though, for the Sonic 3 prototype, except for the special stage. Apparently special stage was like a last minute, like, holy crap, we need to get the special stages in here and the bonus stages because they're all, like, unplayable. The special stage is actually just a tech demo. It doesn't even have any functioning gameplay. It's like, whoa, man, they really crammed this into between, like, October and February, didn't they?
And yet it was the best out of the Genesis series. It's so weird.
It is, yeah. It's just like, it's amazing what you can come up with when time is of the essence, I guess. Yeah. Cool stuff there. Are we ready to get into our main topic now that we've basically covered two topics?
Yeah, I mean, we could go on just to the Q&A, but that's not what we're here today to talk about. Today's topic is actually recommended by one of our patrons.
Indeed, this was a suggestion from none other than our good buddy, Scruffy Matt. And he suggested what you have dubbed the revolving door of morality, Ian, which is very fascinating. This is like the face-heel turn and the heel-face turn tropes of good guys going bad or bad guys going good.
We've talked about narrative tropes in the past, and, you know, mm-hmm. That's such a broad net. Something slipped out. So this particular focus question is our take on that good old face turn, heel turn, the good guy going bad, the bad guy going good, our thoughts on it, you know, its implementation and whatnot. And overall, I'm a fan of it. It's always fun to see the bad guy come around, learn their lesson. A satisfying redemption arc is just so good. Mm-hmm. Like Zuko out of Avatar. Right, yep. There. That's
a major example.
Ah, creme de la creme. Wonderful stuff. Or stories where the heroic character loses faith and completely falls apart and, you know, sides with the bad guys. None of that is springing immediately to mind, but when it happens, it's delightful. I mean, it's terrible, of course. You don't want bad things to happen to good characters, but seeing that deconstruction is cathartic, satisfying in a way.
Yeah.
And it's engaging at the very least.
Oh, yeah. Like Zero from the Mega Man X series is a pretty decent example of this, I'd say. He kind of wavers back and forth sometimes throughout the series. Usually he's on heroic sides, but kind of started out as a bad guy and then they fixed him. But he then gets, he's basically haunted by nightmares of his evil, of his internal struggle. So, yeah, it's fascinating.
Oh, here we go. Arthas from World of Warcraft, or rather, Warcraft 3. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget our past here. The next in line, the virtuous paladin knight who sets out to drive back the undead scourge and whose fixation on saving the people by any means necessary eventually leads him to becoming the Lich King, a high-ranking leader within the very enemy he sought to purge from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the cinematics for that game... Oh, no, yeah, that was Warcraft 3. The cinematics in that game have aged incredibly well, all things considered.
I'm thinking back on it, and yeah, I'd actually agree with you. Yeah, from what I've seen of it, yeah, they're actually pretty good.
And just the scene where he's approaching the throne, having supposedly become returning victorious, and the king starts getting weirded out a minute too late and, son, what are you doing? Succeeding you, father. Curse stab! It's like, oh! Oh, no! What? I mean, there's been a... He's left a trail of heroic bodies in his wake up to this point, but just, oh, that moment. Chilling. Just, oh, so good. The problem is when you have a long-running narrative, usually a serial narrative, and you had this really engaging villain who people liked so much that you turn him around to the good guys, or you had this really incredible arc where the hero fell from grace, and then you build them back up in the opposite direction to get them back to the old status quo, but then people liked him better in that old way, or the path you took was not that great, so you go back again. And that's where the narrative trope falls apart for me, is when it's the revolving door of morality.
Yeah.
I'm looking kind of squarely at you, Magneto.
Yeah, Zero also suffers from this.
To a degree, but...
Less so. It's more of fan interpretations and stuff that seem to kind of put him in this role more than anything.
Yeah, and it's also not so much his choices as outside influences trying to corrupt him. That's a little different.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I mean, it can get tiresome when the plot is every single time, oh, let's make Zero the ultimate killing weapon. And it's like, we've done this. We've seen it. He's overcome it. Move on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking like specifically Magneto out of X-Men, who was, you know, the big grandstanding villain who had a sympathetic motivation. Well, that means he can't be all bad. Yes, it does. Let's have him see the light and come around and be this fun, arrogant, grumpy uncle. But he's on the side of good, except he's disillusioned and no, no, he's gone full bad again. And around and around and around she goes. And...
I do quite enjoy this trope. I love it a lot, but it definitely has, it gets overplayed sometimes, and it's very cliched here and there, but I still enjoy it. It's still fun to see, like, especially, I especially like villains that become good guys, because I feel like it's, when they still keep sort of that villainous streak, and they're not necessarily like, oh, it's a complete morality shift for them, but it's like, oh, they're more of like maybe an anti-hero, or in a way they're still kind of villainous, but they're on the side of the heroes. It's, I like that sort of dynamic, personally. But good guys going bad is also a lot of fun. I mean, we can just think of like, I don't know, the only one I can think of right off the top of my head is a Green Ranger, but it's like, that's not a great example, but especially because he started out as a bad guy and then became good. So he didn't like start out good and then become bad and then become good again. I don't know. Anyway, go ahead. It's like the only example I can think of though.
It can be very effectively used, but I feel like you have to build it into where you're going.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just arbitrarily decide, okay, we're going to make the character good now, or we're going to make them bad now. There has to be an end game to it, because one, that's going to affect the arc of the character themselves. Their switch will feel shallow or contrived. You know, there was a lot of complaints in... what was the name of the story arc? The one where Hal Jordan becomes Parallax.
I don't know. You
know, I'm losing my geek right here. Basically, the story arc was that he fails to save a city, has a complete crisis of faith, and goes full on evil overlord in an effort to make things right. And there was some issue with it because apparently a similar scenario had happened in the storyline just prior, and it focused on his personal fortitude, seeing him through the crisis and moving forward virtuously. So when the same thing happens and this time he crumbles, as if there was no correlation, people kind of cried foul.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back and they say, actually, he was infected by this little evil yellow worm. He didn't go evil. It was just this other thing. And part of that is more of a systemic problem within the Western serial comics anyway. But it comes back to the point of, you have to know where you're going with this. I'm sure a lot of factors came into that story, editorial insight, you know, fan backlash, yada, yada, yada. but you need to know what this is doing, how the character's going, and what does it do for the character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, having the good guy turn bad is cool and all, but if that's all there is to it, you just want to have the bad version of the character, it's a disservice to the character, and it's a disservice to those who are consuming the story, because it's just on the face. There's nothing there's nothing to it. It's all superficial. There needs to be an actual reason for this character change, and what does it do to them? Where does it take their personal narrative? How does it affect them and their worldview? How they interact with the greater cast? How does the cast react to them? Where does it take your story? You know, what changes the flow of the narrative for here? And I realize we're using terminology here that not everyone is familiar with. I blame this entirely on my college roommate freshman year. He was big into WWE, and I was not. But he gave me an appreciation for the franchise.
I have kind of the same sort of thing where I had a whole bunch of friends who liked wrestling, even though I wasn't necessarily a big fan of it. So, yeah, I know, like, this the terminology and stuff. So, but, yeah, this is some stuff that people may not know about.
Like, just quick aside, I was also big into DBZ at the time, and he didn't like anime at all. So we came to agreement. I would watch Saturday Night Raw or whatever with him. He watched DBZ with me. And we came to the conclusion that it's the same show, it's just one with lasers.
It's pretty much the same thing, yeah.
And while, you know, WWE is not my thing, I really do have to admire these athletes who are really super bulky and yet pulling off some crazy acrobatics.
Yeah.
Without killing each other every single night. That's impressive.
Absolutely. And these ridiculous over the top characters that they have. It's just like, oh, it's beautifully stupid.
But anyway, in wrestling, if you are a face, it's short for baby face. You are a good guy. You are the John Cena. You are. Was The Rock a face? I'm pretty sure he was.
He wavered back and forth a bit, but he was mostly a face. Yeah, Hulk Hogan,
for the most part,
spent most of his, or at least his early career, as a face.
And then a heel is a villain, and it's this for wrestling. It's pretty much one or the other. There is no gray morality. You are either a hero or a villain, and it's kind of fun in that clear distinction. And if a heroic character does fall from grace to be rebuilt as a villainous character, it's called a heel turn, because they turned into a heel. And if you make a face turn, you've got a villainous character who goes heroic. One of the primary examples that stands out in my mind is when I started watching, it was when Hulk Hogan returned to the franchise. And he was introduced with two other veterans, and they were the Wolfpack, I think.
No, this was WCW, and this was when they formed the NWO, the New World Order.
Ah, thank you.
The Wolfpack was an offshoot of the NWO.
All right.
I don't know how I know all this stuff necessarily. I've like read and watched a lot of all this stuff, but I have not like actually watched much actual wrestling in my life. So it's really weird. It's weird, though. It's just like these deep dives into like Wikipedia and TV Tropes pages on wrestling and stuff. That's like, oh, that's really cool. That's fascinating. That's interesting. Or that's stupid. Why did they do that? And so it's like, I know all this stuff, and yet I don't know anything about it. This is so weird.
Point is, he was one of a trio of new villains. He was still Hulk Hogan, but he was coming back as a villain.
Right. Yes.
Primarily up against The Rock, who was at the top of his game.
No, this was WCW, so this Rock wasn't a thing yet. This would have been like, I forget who it was, but
that's gotta be, because I remember the fights.
I think Goldberg and stuff was around for, this is WCW, though. This was like before The Rock. This was not WWF, but he did come back to WWF, and I think I don't know if he was in WCW. Or I don't know if maybe NWO did come to WWF after WWF bought WCW, but
I think it's that might have been. Remember,
okay, that might have been what
it
happened.
It was because when The Rock was big, and he was starring in The Scorpion King, so they had to write him out of the story.
So that
he could film.
Okay, this so is
Hulk
later.
Hogan and his buddies beat him up and like threw him in an ambulance and then hit the ambulance with a truck.
Okay, that's right. This is later. Okay, yeah, all right, because. Yeah, I'm thinking WCW was like early mid to kind of late 90s, and then by 2000 it was kind of dead, and then they brought most people over from WCW to WWF, and yeah, it's just a big cluster. I get it. Okay, now veteran I understand. Now I understand where we are in this. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
reintroduced as a villain, except the fans wouldn't accept it. They loved Hulk Hogan too much. So they wrote in a face turn for him so he could go back to the yellow leotard and the pink feather boa and being heroic Hogan, just because nobody would accept him as a villain. And I saw it numerous times when I was watching it, in, you know, characters who were introduced as one thing and just didn't resonate with viewers, they would do a real hard turn.
Yep, they still do.
And see if they would work as a villain. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And sometimes it was just kind of fun to watch them flip-flop. Kurt Angle, I think it was, the Olympic wrestler.
Yeah, yep.
Who, he had some of the wildest turns. And it was really fun because he could play the super squeaky clean Boy Scout and then just the vilest dude bro enforcer heel. Mm-hmm. And he would do it on a dime. Like, it would be every other week. It's all of a sudden, up, he's with the bad guys again. And for him, I don't know. Kurt made it work. It was funny. It was entertaining. Not sure. See, my knowledge of the history is not sure. I'm not sure where Macho Man Randy Savage fell on the spectrum. I think he was a man of his own kind.
He really flipped back and forth a lot. And
I can't do that.
he might have been what they call a tweener, which is someone who sits between face and heel. A kind of walks the line back and forth occasionally here and there. There's some characters like that. So there is actually like a gray morality in wrestling. But again, it's still kind of a defined thing. So it's not like a guy, you don't know what their allegiances are, but they're still fairly predictable. So it's wrestling. It's not very deep.
We've gotten off on a tangent. The point is, I feel like if you're going to make the face or the heel turn with your character in whatever story you're telling, there has to be a greater thinking to it than just the turn.
Sure.
There has to be a reason for a legitimate reason, whether it's an outside influence in the narrative or internal within the character themselves. And you have to follow through with it. There has to be consequences, whether it's they find a new calling and, you know, rise up, or they lose everything and fall down. There, it has to have some kind of impact. And if you've built this kind of roller coaster, like say you have a virtuous character who has their fall from grace, but then claws their way back up, that's fine. You can have that, you know, complete reversal, but it needs to be part of their arc and it needs to be part of the narrative. It has to serve a purpose. It can't just be, oh, he's cool as a hero, but he's cool as a villain. But no, he's cool as a hero again, because it becomes disingenuous and the reader isn't going to want to follow it anymore, because at any given point, all that they've invested into this character's journey can be thrown out the window because, oh, well, we're retreading this ground again.
Yeah.
I would dare say you could almost make another turn, virtuous character fall from grace, tries to claw their way back up, but then falls down again. But at that point, I'm figuring that has to be the end of their story. You have to wrap it up, because if you keep going back and forth, it's just going to get silly. There's no reason to be invested because the character isn't actually going to end up anywhere.
Yeah. One thing I kind of like is also villains who they're like maybe like lackeys, or they're like sort of underlings, or they work with another more powerful villain, and that villain kind of turns on them and then makes the lower level villain kind of realize that, oh, well, screw this guy, then I'm going on my own, or I'm gonna go hang out with the heroes, and then the heroes are gonna be like, oh, what are you doing here, and get away from me, and I hate you, and there's going to be all sorts of drama there too. So I like that kind of aspect of like maybe a character's morality doesn't necessarily shift like in much of any way, but it's just the fact that they were betrayed by the other people that they work with that they kind of change allegiances or maybe even become like a really weird sort of chaos center in between the two. So it could be like, oh, what's this character going to do? It's like that sort of interesting mystery of like, how is this character going to react to what the heroes are doing versus what the villain is doing? It kind of throws a little bit of an unknown quantity into the mix, which I kind of like that. I kind of enjoy that. It's interesting to see that. And I don't think that's used very much. I don't see that too often. No. I don't see that too often.
Part of it too is that when it's not a morality shift, but an allegiance shift, like you said,
yeah,
you've got a volatile combination of characters that has to go somewhere. It can't just be the status quo of the lackey who is still evil is working out of convenience with the heroes. Eventually there's got to be some kind of break. Otherwise you have all this tension and what's it doing?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going with it?
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's
one prime example, Snively out of the old Sonic books.
Yep. That is a good
example. He flippity floppied a few times, but a lot of his back and forth was not really explored. When he was with the heroes, he was full on reformed with the heroes. Nobody questioned his allegiance. Nobody really wondered what if he had an alternative motive, and he didn't show any signs of it. It was just he was there doing his thing. So when I came onto the book, I felt like as one of the heroes, he had lost everything interesting about him. There was no interesting dynamic with the other characters. There was nothing to him specifically that made him interesting. So that's why I steered him back over to Eggman. And there you had the more interesting dynamic, and there you could play with the morality of, you know, why is he with Eggman? Why did he leave the heroes? And what consequences does it have for not only him, but those around him? And exploring just what a self-serving, sniveling little snot bucket he actually was.
Right. I definitely agree with that. Yeah, there's definitely it kind of like is a character that becomes, when a character becomes popular enough and they just kind of switch their allegiances or their morality just for the sake of them being popular that doesn't necessarily work out so well for me. So it's like a character, they become kind of a character that can be truly fascinating as a villain becomes really lame as a hero. It can happen. Yes. So, I feel like Knuckles sort of works in this, except he's not really a villain, but he's more like just a nemesis as he was been described before.
Yeah, Knuckles he started out as an antagonistic force, but that was part of the misdirection.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's...
And then after that, he kind of lost his bite, and then when Shadow came out, he just kind of fell by the wayside.
Right.
Which is heartbreaking, because he's my boy!
Mm-hmm, I agree. I definitely agree, so... But, yeah. That's a Sonic example, I would say. Shadow and Knuckles both kind of fit this a little bit. So, all right. Well, are we ready to move on into the Q&A, Ian?
I believe so. If you want your question answered here on the show, either email us at bumblecast@yahoo.com, comment in any of the YouTube videos, tweet to us at bumblecast, and if you're a patron, post anywhere on the Patreon page or ask it in the Q&A channel on Discord. If you want your question answered sooner rather than later, you can throw $5 our way to get priority in the Q&A queue. Become a patron over at patreon.com/bumblecast or throw $5 our way on ko-fi.com. That's ko-fi.com/bumblecast. Just make sure to include your name and your question or we won't really know what you're doing with that $5.
But thank you for your $5 all the same. First one comes to us from Eggman Inc. In Sonic Universe number 88, it's stated that a catastrophic event blasted Pancardina into a series of islands with the trolls, Walter Nagus's race, being all but wiped out overnight. What was this event, or what caused it?
That is all stuff that I will cover in Lost Hedgehog Tales, a collection of things that I plan to do with the series, but couldn't because of cancellations and all sorts of rigmarole. The project is on permanent hiatus as I work out other things behind the scenes. I'm so sorry that I keep saying this, but I might as well mention it here. Something occurred to me, and I remembered some little stuff off to the side that should be safe for public consumption. So it's a very small update. It's not going to address anything that anyone is looking to have addressed, but everyone has been so patient over the years, I want to do something. So there is a very small Lost Hedgehog Tales update in the works. I just need to make sure that I phrase everything correctly and revise that page on the website and all that. So you can look forward to that in the near-ish future. I also am going to try to see if I can poke and prod a few places, see if maybe things have shifted so I can maybe possibly move forward. But that just depends on talking to the right people at the right time, and that's out of my control.
All right. Next question comes from Andrew D. The solicit for issue 25 was recently revealed, and it seemed like it still deals with the metal virus. I was under the assumption that every 12 issues is a separate season. Is 25 still part of season 2, or is the metal virus saga taking up some of season 3 as well?
Now, part of this is a assumption that I've seen a lot of people make online, and part of it is a bit of confusion between terminology and whatnot between me and IDW, and part of that is just the series being so new. But why are you assuming that everything is going to follow a standard set by the first 12 issues? That is a very small sample size. You cannot come to any real conclusions off of that. It's bad science! I don't like the year. I know I was pushing the term year one initially because it was year one. The first year of the book, first arc is just 1 year, focusing on that. But now that we're moving on into the greater series, think of it more as season one and season two. Season one is shorter, only 13 issues if you want to count the annual. Mm-hmm. And season two will be longer than that. It is longer than I initially intended. I will admit to that. But part of that comes from needing to fit things into the four-issue format of the trades. So we can't really break up a storyline between trades. That's just bad pool. And part of it is I really want to use this book to showcase the extended cast because we don't really get them in the games anymore. So to give everyone their due and not just rush through to a conclusion, I decided to let things linger just a little bit. But I do want this wrapped up. So we are definitely on the descent towards the climax, but don't expect season two to wrap up anytime soon.
How do you descend towards the climax?
I don't know.
Okay. Just check.
Pump the brakes so you don't slide, I guess.
Okay. Next question comes from Koopaling Crew. Our last priority Q&A question for this episode. Perhaps you can discuss your thoughts on TV or book series that were canceled or put on hiatus but saw the light of day, thanks in part to fans. The biggest one I can think of is Mystery Science Theater 3000. Multiple times.
I was thinking of Quantum Leap.
That's also one, yeah.
Like, we thought it was just, you know, a long time in between seasons, and then there was a actual promo by the network of a network head getting inundated with mail saying, okay, we've heard you, please stop asking, we're bringing it back.
Yeah, Star Trek the Original Series, that's also another one. That came back pretty much twice, really, with season 3 and then with the movies.
Well, didn't Young Justice come back? Like, Netflix swooped in to save them for season 3?
I forget who it was, but yeah, Young Justice. Yeah, there was a season 3. There was a push for a season 3 of Young Justice, and then apparently, according to a lot of people who watched it, they kind of bungled it, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of the whole series, to be honest, but Sonic X got a third season, from what I understand, because of fan demand in France.
Aha, uh-huh, yeah. And that's the one that's going to be airing in Japan finally for the first time. Because
yeah, I didn't realize that it hadn't come out over there. I thought it was just debuting in France first and then spread. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is pretty wild. They actually like produced the show and everything for Western audiences, produced the season for Western audiences and never had it come out here at all.
How
or come out in Japan at all. Sorry, not it came out here, but not in Japan. Yeah, and now they're replaying it as promotion for the new movie, which is very odd.
Interesting. Don't really quite see the synergy between the two, but okay.
I guess if you want to have like Sonic being in the real Earth world, I guess that's the only kind of synergy. Sonic hanging out with a human.
Except season 3 takes place in space.
Well, I don't know. I didn't watch it. What do you think I am? Like, someone who watches things?
Because like season 1 is Sonic and company come to the human world and there's a bunch of antics and it's fairly standalone stuff and it's arguably the stronger of the series.
See, I thought that's what the whole series was. I didn't know they did different things. I'm not. And I don't know. What do you take me for?
I'm educating you.
Listen, okay, thank you.
The season finale ends with Super Sonic accidentally bringing more stuff over into the human world, including Angel Island, which just had me flipping out because it's floating along and you hear Tikal's voice and you're like, what? Season 2 was an adaptation of Sonic Adventure, Sonic Adventure 2, and very loosely Sonic Battle. And the budget was gone and the adaptations were mixed. And it culminates with everybody going back to Sonic's world and the two planets splitting apart again. And then season 3 is aliens invade Sonic's world and it leads to this interstellar chase and weird stuff. Season 3 is really weird. It's like incredibly dark, like super grim dark in some areas. And I don't know. It's a weird season.
Kind of reminds me, makes me think of the 2012 Ninja Turtles where they go in space because of course they do. So, yeah, that's interesting. I should probably watch Sonic X someday. I'll think about it. All right, are we ready to get into the standard Q&A?
We are.
All right, first one comes from Jules Scar. What kind of wolf would you say Whisper is? Red, gray, eastern, etc.? I think Whisper's she's an etc. wolf to
Whisper is a wolf in the same way that Sonic is a hedgehog and Big and Blaze are both cats. There are no species distinctions. I have seen people make arguments about which species of hedgehog Sonic could be. I've seen folks make a decent argument that Big is technically a Maine Coon cat, but it's like, what type of octopus is Mimic? He's an octopus. I mean, clearly a Mimic octopus, but that's the joke in the name. It's like, what kind of fox is Tails? He's just a fox, just like Cream is just a rabbit. Yes, I know you could say she's a lop, but that's besides the point. They don't have distinct individual species. They're just kind of nouns.
Sure. Makes sense. Next question comes from PC the Unicorn. So people have been making fan art between the two series for as long as I could remember, and that since now both are being published by the same company, I'm curious as to how you would approach making an official My Little Pony Friendship is Magic and Sonic the Hedgehog crossover. Would the cast of MLP be in Sonic's world or vice versa? What specific character interactions between the two series would you want to write? This is getting into ideas territory, but
nah, it's okay, but I'm actually going to steer clear of this one because I agree. I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that at some point we will get this crossover.
Don't be careful, Ian. Don't say that what? It's absolutely going to, or that sounds people are going to interpret it that as like it's going to happen. And don't
I could also say it's never going to happen. Then they're going to say Ian Flynn confirms that it's never going to happen. Series are canceled. World's on fire.
Okay.
I would assume at some point it would happen. It seems logical to me. There is nothing in the works now. I can tell you that. I haven't heard of any talks right now. That being said, I feel like it could likely happen, and I have already put thought into it. since I have worked on both titles, and I would assume, hopefully, please, I would be on tap. So I don't want to get into specifics just in the case of accidentally spoiling a crossover that hasn't happened yet, you know?
Right.
Suffice to say, I would like to see them interacting with both worlds, and depending on how generous the license holders are, get kind of crazy with that. And just find the best opportunities to play characters both with the same type and against type. I mean, if I don't have Sonic and Rainbow Dash race at some point, I think the mob will come for me, you know?
Oh, it's yeah, you'll be dead. You will be dead. That's not men's words.
No. And rightfully so. I mean, let's not argue that point.
Right, exactly.
So I'm going to duck out of this question because I do have thoughts and I don't want to potentially undercut myself. You dig?
Right. Makes sense. So, but it's a possibility that it may happen at some point in the future. So that's right. Something to look forward to, at least, maybe, hopefully. All right. Next question comes from Matthew P. In the IDW Sonic comics, it's been established that Sonic and his friends live on one world while the humans live on another. If that's the case, how did Sonic Adventure, Sonic Adventure 2, Shadow the Hedgehog, and Sonic Unleashed play out? Did Gunn, Professor Pickle, and Gerald Robotnik, or any humans for that matter, exist in Sonic's world, or were the humans extinct when the games occurred in the comic?
Wait, what? Extinct? Why would they be extinct?
I don't know. Don't ask.
No, it's...
Ian, don't ask these things. It's very weird and confusing, and this is a very obvious retcon that was made just to kind of... for no reason. That's really all I can think of. There's no reason for this.
I laid this at Yuji Naka's feet. You know, Yuji Naka was big on the consolidation of the franchise in the late 90s. It was him that introduced the two-world thing.
Right, because it happened in Sonic Adventure.
We saw it reflected in Sonic X. It was not properly explained in the games. But, you know, it's something that Izuka-san inherited, that I inherited. And we got to make do. But the events of Sonic Adventure happened on the human world. So Sonic and company were on the human world when it happened. How? I don't know.
Why was
Angel Island there? I don't know.
Yeah, don't ask how Angel Island got there.
Why is Angel Island tied to geographic locations on the human world when it exists in Sonic's world? I don't know. I can make up ways to pave over that gaping pothole, but I don't have an official answer, and I don't know. So if humans are around, assume it happened on the human world. If there's no humans, assume it happened on Sonic's world. Why are they going back and forth? How do they go back and forth? I don't know. It hasn't really affected the main plot lines of the games, and we're just going to kind of smile and nod and move forward with this. If we ever go to the human world in the comics, we'll maybe address it. Or tap dance around it. I don't know. It depends on what Sega lets us do with it. But that's basically what you can boil it down to. If are humans present, it's the human world. Are humans not present, Sonic's world. And let's just leave it at that. That's as simple as I can make it.
Alrighty. Next question comes from Liam B. What, if anything, is the one rule you cannot break if you want to make a good piece of art or entertainment? It seems history's great works are a list of pieces that broke the rules. But is there one that is absolutely unbreakable?
No. Art is art.
I agree.
You may not get it. You may not find it appealing. You may be offended by it. You may look at it and go, that's just a toilet seat mounted on the wall. What are you talking about? That's not art. Doesn't matter. Art is art.
Yep.
And if it's your cup of tea, awesome. Enjoy it. If it's not, well, sorry. Find something else.
Exactly. There's no shortage. Especially these days. There's so much freaking stuff these days, Ian. I can't keep up. I can't do it.
I mean, I roll my eyes at a lot of the, what do you even call it now, postmodernism or whatnot.
Sure.
You know, here is a square canvas that's blue.
Like an abstract.
But the meaning is behind how they, which direction they use the roller brush on it. I just kind of roll my eyes at that, but I'm not going to say it's not art. I'm just saying it doesn't appeal to me.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. And finally, our last question comes from TyrannoRex5. Is Sally Acorn gay or bi? She liked Sonic before the reboot, but it was implied that she went for Nicole after the reboot. Did the wave change her?
Yeah, the wave changed everything. Don't think of post-wave as a continuation. Think of it as a brand new start, because that's basically what we had to do.
Right.
We tried to incorporate as many of the older ideas and elements as we could, but it was a fresh take, with homages to what came before purely for fan service, not actually connected to any previous established lore stuff. The intention, we never actually got to do it, but the intention was that Sally would be bi, so that she did have interest in Sonic in the early days, and things didn't work out between them, and that she would eventually move on with Nicole. We've said it before on the show, the furthest we got were some kind of light implications during the Sally and Nicole arc in Sonic Universe. That was like supposed to be the very basic foundation that we would eventually build off of. So we didn't actually get to confirm or do anything with it, but that was our thinking at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe Sally is technically pansexual because Nicole is a computer.
I suppose you could look at it that way. Sure.
I don't know. I just had that idea randomly, just threw it out here. It's probably whatever. I'm not word of God. Don't listen to me. I was just thinking well, she's technically a computer, so I don't know. But, I mean, obviously she did not. Sally didn't really develop any sort of feelings for Nicole until she actually gained a body and some level of autonomy and sentience. Although she was always kind of sentient, but whatever, it's fine. Ian, let's close this out.
And then there's sapience, there's cognitive ability, and then there's individual identity.
Okay, yeah. You and your knowing of words and things. You know, smart. How dare you? Anyway, we done?
I think we're done.
Alrighty.
Before we wrap up the show, we're going to give a big thank you to everyone who is a patron over at patreon.com/bumblecast. You guys make this show awesome because you are awesome. And so is your money. Big thank you to Daniel H., Eric F., Connell T., Alex P., Eggman Inc., Justin F., Andrew D., Blue Title Gamer, Coupling Crew, Saturn Flicky, Chris A., John B., Jennifer R., Revan the Light, Lisa M., Frederick, Spider Dreamer, Scruffy Matt, PC the Unicorn, Duiz Dizdin, Dave M., Mike B., Samuel P., Sam Cybercat, Digama F. Wow, Brody M., Neil H., Justin G., Dan M. S., Silly String, Takaro, Lee H. K., Chevelle, Don B., Sen Fritz, John M., James K., Adam B. T., and Overthinking Films.
Thank you, everybody, for your patronage and for your support, and we love you in a platonic way, for the most part.
Now that the show's wrapping up, where can they find you?
They can head on over to twitter.com/KyleJCRB, and they can find me there. You can talk to me. We can talk about fun things like how the new Tesla Cybertruck looks absolutely ridiculous and silly. And I even though it does still look pretty silly, I actually kind of love it because it looks so ridiculous and silly and dumb.
Bold to do an N64 remake of an actual vehicle.
It's more like PS1, but whatever. Yeah. Just needs that texture warping and it's good to go. You just need to add that on there. You can also find me over at kngi.org, where you can find archived episodes of the Bumblecast in the MP3 format for your listening and downloading pleasure. You can also find my other show there, Nitro Game Injection, which you can also listen to streaming live on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. All that information and everything on that is available over at kngi.org. What about you, Ian?
You can find me on Twitter at IanFlynnBKC. You can follow my release schedule and entire portfolio over at BumbleKing.com. And please do follow my brand new original webcomic series, Drogune. That's DROGUNE.com. Updates are every Friday. And if you're not already a patron of the show, you could possibly be a patron of Drogune as well. That's Patreon.com/Drogune.
Don't forget to follow the show at Bumblecast on Twitter. You can also email us your questions, comments, and hate mail and everything at bumblecast@yahoo.com. You can listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and, of course, YouTube.
You can also help support us and the show by going over to the Bumble Store. That's shop.spreadshirt.com/bumblestore. We have a number of designs that you can plaster on just about every single consumable object that is legal and good. If you want to do it on something illegal, we don't cater to that directly.
Yes, the Bumblecast merch is for good boys and girls.
My.
Don't forget, you can also check out Bumblecast Gaming live streams on Twitch at twitch.tv/BumblecastGaming on Sundays at around 10 p.m. Eastern Time, as well as other times throughout the week. Keep an eye on the Bumblecast Twitter for announcements. All that good stuff.
That's going to wrap it up for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us as we've rambled on and on about games and morality, because really, what is there more in life?
Yes. I have nothing. I agree.
What is there more to life?
Probably not.
Oh well. Night, everybody.
See ya.
Sandra Flickley, Chris A. My list is not scrolling.
That's useful.
Doing yes, Scruffy's a special boy. Who's a special boy, Scruffy? He's you. Another thing on the plate. Crap. Okay, cool. No, it's fine. Everything's fine. No panicking.
Calm down, Ian. Calm down.
I'm perfectly calm.
You've been listening to the Bumblecast, a co-production of Bumble King Comics and the KNGI Network. Original theme music composed by Ken Coda Snyder. Remixed intro by T-Lopes. Find out more information, along with podcast feeder links, MP3 downloads, and more at bumbleking.com and kngi.org.
The Pokemon they were showing off, I just did not like the designs. And then the leaks happened, and I'm going through the new decks, and I'm like, most of these are garbage, wouldn't want to catch, no thanks. And then all the other stuff started coming up, and it's like, nah, thanks. I mean, if you're enjoying it, then I'm glad, and I'm not meaning to disparage your enjoyment. It's just, it's not something I could overlook. Yeah. That being said, of the new ones that I would say are neat-looking, Dreepy is one of them.
People hate that game, apparently.
Really depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
Either it's lighthearted fun, stop being a jerk, or it's absolute garbage. Why are you reinforcing Game Freak?
Yeah. What I think people were hoping that moving to a console would mean a more console-like experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people understand that Game Freak's been making the same game ad nauseum for how long now? 20 years?
Well, that's the thing, is that it's so far behind the handheld versions in terms of content that's what kind of sticks in my craw.
Okay,
is,
yeah.
Like, it's visually less appealing than Let's Go, which was a full-on cash grab game.
Yeah, a remake is the first.
You don't have the Pokemon following you. You don't have 66% of the decks, which I'm not... That wasn't a big deal for me, because out of the 900-something critters, there's probably 200 worth remembering. The rest are fodder, but it's kind of the principle of the matter. They took out like 140-something moves. There's no global trading system. It's like all these neat features that have come and gone in the series as it's progressed just are not there.
Yeah.
And it's, meh.
It feels like they got in over their heads, not realizing just how much work it would be to move over a handheld game to a console game. And the expectations were super high.
Yeah. It's kind of like the new Fire Emblem, where it's very clearly rushed. And Aaliyah brought this up, and I agree with her. It almost looks like they started developing for the 3DS and then moved it to the Switch.
There's probably a lot of games like that, yeah.
With not a lot of time to do everything, because there's a lot of background textures that are super dithered or pixelated that would have looked fine on a 3DS screen, but mm-hmm. are just awful on a TV screen. But I can overlook it because the core gameplay is kind of fun. The voice acting is stellar, the writing is excellent, and the game itself is entertaining, and the visuals, where they are lacking in some places, they aren't too glaring for the most part. But with everything I've seen on Pokemon, it's like there's a couple of flashes of brilliance, but then there's other stuff that's like this wouldn't pass on the 3DS version. Like for me, that's kind of, I guess that's the measuring stick. The Sun and Moon were so good, at least to me, that I figured, okay, a bigger, better version on the Switch is what we should be doing, and this looks like it is a lesser version.
Yeah, I see, like, the battles, especially, to me, look very lifeless. Like, there's not much going on. Like, Pokemon go in for an attack, and it just, like, kind of zooms in and shows, like, just a minor, like, slashing animation or something. It doesn't actually show the Pokemon fighting each other, really.
And to a degree...
And I'm just like, well, that's what we'd expect from the handheld versions, maybe, but going to consoles, you would expect a little bit more in that department, especially considering battling is like the main draw, the big thing for Pokemon. That's what it would be. So I don't know.
And I'm not saying that all 400 in this game have to have unique attack animations for every possible move. That's just not feasible.
No, that's extreme, especially given the development time they had.
Yeah, previous games have had done more with less, so.
Yeah.
So now that we've done, like, a fair amount of content for a show, should we actually do the show?
It's funny. Unfortunately, I started recording it late, but I think that's okay. We still got 5 minutes of it, so I can... Maybe I can chuck it in somewhere. I don't know. I'll figure it out. Maybe at the end of the show.